Good morning, Pathways. I'm Jonathan. It's my privilege here to be the Student Ministries Pastor, and it's my privilege this morning to be with you. Speaking of the students, so just a little snapshot of what the students are doing. It's our paradigm to try to help the students learn how to ask questions of God and the Word. We think that the scripture comes alive, that there's all this meat and mystery and wonder and fascination when they're asking questions of the stuff that's in between the sentences, of the stuff that there's no right or wrong answer, but helps the passage come alive. So that's the format for today's message. As I was studying today's passage, I wrestled and struggled with three questions, and I'm going to present those questions to you. So today we are in John chapter 4, and I'm going to read out of the NIV, and we're at the end of the chapter. But to give you a little background context, this is where Jesus is walking through Samaria to get to his home region of Galilee. And on his way, he meets the woman at the well. She comes to faith. She starts spreading the word. The Samaritans want to hear about him, and they ask him to stay, and he stays for another 2 whole days, which is an amazing sermon unto itself. We'll let Pastor Eddie do that one. So we pick up Jesus after he's leaving Samaria. So at verse 43, it reads, after the 2 days he left for Galilee, now Jesus himself had pointed out that a prophet has no honor in his own country. A prophet has no honor in his own country. I mean, to be fair, this is the verse when we got assigned, and I was looking through the snapshots of Jesus that spoke to me. It was this verse that caught my eye. I'm guessing that it has to be the source for that phrase that we know so well, that familiarity breeds contempt. As an example, my daughter Sydney, when she was younger, she bit her lip or something. She had a little cut on the inside. It wasn't healing the way she wanted it to. She gets nervous about these things. She comes flying down the stairs. Mom, Jonathan, look at this. And she's freaked out. And she's like, look at this thing. And we look at it and we're like, Sydney, this is normal. This is, et cetera. And she gives us this look that kind of says, why did I even ask you? And she goes to see her grandmother, who happened to be staying with us this weekend. And we can hear the conversation. And she's like, Grandma. And again, Grandma gives her pretty much the exact same answer. To which Sydney, you would think, says, oh, well, I have the wisdom of my grandmother, my mother, my stepfather. So this should be the end of it. No. Later on, she goes out for a one-on-one with her youth leader. And she comes back and she is totally at peace. And she excitedly tells us the story of how Jen looked at it. And Jen said this thing. And so, of course, that's what it is. And Sonia and I looked at each other and was like, that's exactly what we said. A prophet has no honor in his home country. Every parent understands this. Right? Familiarity breeds contempt. And so I want to make this point. Being the student ministries pastor, just to take a little bit of a side here. Parents, can we talk about the constellation of adults? I was going to have this parent orientation this coming month, and all the rising parents, all the middle school parents, and I'd have like 5 picture frames to give you, and they'd be empty. And I'd say, parents, you need to find 5 adults who will invest in, pour in, love on your teenager all the way through their high school, all the way through their college, all the way through the 20s, into their adulting years. Because a prophet has no honor in his own country. Because other people can say the same things to your kids, and your kids will hear it because it comes from somewhere else, someone else. And even better, if it's intergenerational, if you have different generations represented in those 5 picture frames. There's no magic bullet in youth ministry as to why or how students raised in church will stay with God all the way through their adulting years. But the thing they do have in common, it seems, is that all of those students who made it into adulting, still walking with God, still loving the church, all had several people from all the different generations who loved on them. And part of that constellation of adults is from this a prophet has no honor in his own country. By the way, pathways. We have students here who are college-aged and older who have been in our youth groups, and we need to give them incredible props for making it through. That may be the hardest transition in church, I think, one of, is to become an adult in the church in which you were a child. I ran into someone from my old hometown. I had lost touch over like 20-odd years, and we were sharing stories, and what do you do? And I said, oh, I'm a pastor. And she stopped dead and looked at me and said, you're a what? Familiarity breeds contempt. For the students who have made it all the way into adulting from their childhood years, we need to give them a rich encouragement of opportunities to become adults here. We need to provide them support. We need to provide them props and cheers. And we need to become the kind of place where all the 20s and 30s from other churches that just couldn't swing it in their childhood church couldn't find opportunities to grow here and find family and God's love here. If you're at all interested in making that happen, please do reach out this week and contact me. Email, text, something. Like, there's no plans in place. There's no initiative in place. We're not launching a new thing yet, but I am gathering a team of people to pray and listen and consider and plan. So I admit that I wander here. So let's go back to the text. Here's my first question. I told you there'd be three questions of Jesus. My first question is this. Why does Jesus keep trying to reach those who continue to reject him? Right, when I first asked myself that question, I was like, it's his job. He's supposed to. But that seems a little selfish, right? When you read through the Gospels and you read through all the different stories and all the different miracles and teachings and you start plotting the geography, so much happened in his hometown. He kept going back to his home region. He kept trying to reach the people who kept rejecting him. This miracle and this teaching and that teaching and this miracle. And he just kept getting disappointed. And it made me ask this brutal question of myself. And so I pose it to you. How have I been ignoring God's voice in my life? How long has God been trying to get hold of me and my attention? And the little things that I keep hanging on to, the sinful parts of me that I won't let go of, the stubborn, the arrogant parts of me that just think, well, I'm right. In what area of my life is God still trying to say, let me be Lord in that part of your life? In what part of my life have I unintentionally, accidentally become deaf to hearing his voice? Here's the fun thing about doing church this way on a Sunday morning is that this is recorded. So you have every right and option. You can just pause the recording right now. If you want to turn to your friend, your partner, your spouse, your children, you want to have a family devotion on some of these questions, you have questions of your own from this passage, feel free to just pause and talk about them. Call up your small group. I don't care where they are in the country. Call them up right now and have a conversation. And when you're ready to move on, hit play again. This is kind of a neat feature of having church this way. By the way, all of you received this morning in Pathways, you received an email this morning with a study guide to this message and some further discussion questions. So let's move on. The second question. We're in verse 45. When Jesus arrived in Galilee, the Galileans welcomed him. They had seen all that he had done in Jerusalem at the Passover festival, for they also had been there. Once more, he visited Cana in Galilee, where he turned the water into wine. And there was a certain royal official whose son lay sick at Capernaum. When this man heard that Jesus had arrived in Galilee, he went to him and begged him to come and heal his son, who was close to death. Verse 48. Unless you people see signs and wonders, Jesus told him, you will never believe. The royal official said, sir, come down before my child dies. You can read in the subtext the exclamation points and the effort to be polite. Come down before my child dies. I don't know what you're talking about. Just come down and do this. Jesus replies, go. Your son will live. I'm familiar with this passage. I don't know how many times I've read this passage. My second question, though, came and struck me by surprise. As I was studying, I didn't understand. There's a missed note between 47 and 48. It doesn't flow for me. If I'm, I use this trick with the middle schoolers in the youth group sometimes, like, if you had to shoot this scene like it was a movie and you were the director, like, what emotions would be playing out? What emotion is on Jesus's face? This doesn't make sense. They wanted to come and see him. They had some sort of faith. This man is showing some sort of faith. He needs Jesus to do, and he believes that Jesus can help him. So he comes and he asks him to heal, and he makes this request of Jesus. And in verse 48, I mean, I keep trying in my head to read that in a positive way. Like Jesus is rewarding him for his faith. But it sure does sound to me like a rebuke. There's no sarcasm. It's not like Jesus is like, oh, you people, and he's all cheery. He's not being sarcastic or happy. I imagine this scene, like Jesus just had to take a beat. And almost like he's talking to himself, unless you people see signs and wonders, you'll never believe. And it's almost like he's disappointed, he's sad. But that doesn't make sense to me from verse 47 and all the people who are welcoming him and expressing faith. So here's where a little fancy seminary stuff comes into play. So a little Greek study helps. In verse 47, in verse 48, when he says, you people, and you all will never believe, every time he says you in that sentence, it's the plural. Jesus isn't rebuking the official. He's rebuking everybody. Okay, well, that gets us a little bit, that tells us something, but it doesn't really answer my question of where is this missed note of emotion going on. Here's where a comparison study helps. This passage is really similar to Matthew 8 with the Roman centurion and his really sick servant. But the difference, when you lay them side by side, it starts to become clear. The Roman centurion said to Jesus, I know what command is like. If you command health to my servant, then it will just happen. No need to come. I know it will happen. The Roman centurion displayed his faith. This official couldn't really be bothered to hear what Jesus had to say. Just come. I need you to do this thing. Come. I need you to be physically present, and I need you to do this thing before my child dies. I mean, it's hard to blame this official. His child is near death, and Jesus is preaching about something that isn't like your child is healed. It's hard to not sympathize with him. But if we look at the whole passage and we compare it to the Roman centurion, and we start to think about, well, what kind of question could the official have asked if he had a full understanding and a full faith in who God really was? Would he have said, come, I need you to be present? Or would he have just said, you are God, and if you say it, it will happen? If he had a big enough faith, would he have said, come before my child dies? Or would he have said something huge and big and like, if you say my child will live, then whether they die or not, I know they'll live, or something, just something huge. Like he had it feels like Jesus was rebuking him and everyone watching them for just wanting miracles, for just wanting signs, for just wanting to be entertained. Jesus was using the tools to present who he really was, and the people were focused on the tools. So the question I'm asking myself is, how is God willing to be more in my life? No matter how wise or smart or studied I get, God is always going to be bigger. No matter how passionately I pursue his presence in my life, there's always going to be more that I could see, that I could revel in, that I can celebrate and rejoice in. In what ways am I putting, are you putting God in a very small, too small box? where you're just asking God to do the things for you the way you want them to be done. Worse, would I believe in God, his rebuke? Jesus' rebuke here is, unless you see the signs and wonders. Can I believe without the signs and wonders? This is the challenge for this generation of students, Gen Z and millennials. We have this thing where we see it once and we're done with it. And the students read this passage, oh, we know this passage. We looked at it in children's church, I'm done with it. I know God. I know, I was raised in the church. I know everything about the church. I know everything about Jesus. I'm done with it. As they progress past adolescence, I did Christianity in my childhood. I'm done with it. They're being asked to believe in God without the signs and wonders. And that's a hard thing for them. Because I wonder if we, as the generations before them, are helping them see the everyday wonders and blessings of God. So that's our paradigm in student ministries. We're trying to show them God in their everyday. That is not irrelevant, that is not distant or dusty or out of touch, that he is the incarnate God right now. And he is affecting your life and my life and their life in real ways and measurable ways right now. How do we help each other? How do we help our families? How do we help these students see that? The third question. In verse 50, Jesus just says, he responds to that, to the official's urgency. He responds in kind. The guy's just like, just come. And Jesus says, go. Your son will live. And I love thinking about how he might have looked when he said that. Like, did he use like words of power and like the wind stopped and silence and there were clouds and the sun and he said it in a proclamation way, like, your son will live? Or was it just a quiet moment? My child, my son, go. Your child will live. Did he smile? Did he say it disappointingly? I mean, there's no answer. These are the, I want to know. I want to go back and see. I want to live in this passage, and I want to see and feel how he said it. There's an emotional impact to how he looked, the expression on his face. What expression was on Jesus' face? And then the man responds. The man took Jesus at his word and departed, which is fascinating to me. Because think about the options. If this were one of my students making a request of Jesus, and Jesus gave this answer, I think they would be faced with a decision. I think they'd be wondering, like, okay, do I believe this? And so he went and left and believed? Or is it more likely that today I didn't get what I wanted from God? So I'm done, I'm out. Or I'm confused by this whole, what he just said to me, so that doesn't make sense to me by how I see the world, so I'm done, I'm out. The youth pastors that I'm in community with, we are stricken by how many of our students are willing to leave God on a single note, of a single point that they disagree with of the church or God, and they're like, I'm out, I'm done. We have to help nurture them through their doubts and their struggles and their challenges. We cannot be afraid to talk about relevant issues in ways that are sensitive and kind and yet truthful. Our posture has to be open to say, let us wrestle with these things together. We don't have the answers all together yet, but we're going to find them together. We're going to use the word. We're going to look at this word. And we're going to live as if God is Lord. They're willing to throw out the entirety of God, the entirety of his blessings, the entirety of his salvation, all of the community of church, all the blessings of church on singular points of disagreement because the culture says one thing and they just believe culture. We just believe culture. Verse 51. While the official was still on the way home, the official's servants met him with the news that his boy was living. And when he inquired as to the time of when his son got better, they said to him, "Yesterday, 1 PM, the fever left him." Then the father realized that this was the exact time at which Jesus had said to him, "Your son will live." So he and his whole household believed. This is my final question for the day. Why did the official ask about the time? That's kind of an odd little end note. There's a very specific detail in this passage. Why did he ask about the time of the healing? Didn't he already believe? He took him at his word and departed. So he already believed, right? So why did he ask about the time? Did he already believe in such a way that he was just looking for further proof to tell his servants, the rest, "Hey guys, I really believe this. And just so you know, even more proof that it happened at the exact same time." Or did the official depart with some faith and then put two and two together? And then he fully believed and rejoiced. The context would seem that is the second, that his faith was made whole by the realization of the details of what happened in real life. So, is this a prescriptive verse? Like it's telling us that we should do this thing? Or is it descriptive? It's just describing this is what this guy did, and it's not saying that you should do the same thing. Scripture is just saying this is what happened. Descriptive versus prescriptive. I wonder if there's any harm in looking for measurable details of God in our life today. Is there anything wrong with bolstering our faith with evidence of God truly active in real ways, in real time? I mean, one of the hugest stumbling blocks for Gen Z is that their view of Christianity and God in the Bible is that it's irrelevant. And the way that we do church has no relevance to their lives. And that the messages we preach and the way that we preach don't seem to have any purchase in their daily life. We must share the stories that we're using for ourselves, for our own faith, to bolster each other. We need to share the stories of how God is real. Not in concept, not out there, but last week, come on, this cannot be coincidence. This happened to me, and then this happened to me, and here's the blessing from it. You cannot say that that's a coincidence. Okay, maybe you can. So let me add 5 more stories from last month of how this is how God is real in my life. Here's my last meditation point. How many blessings can I count? In last month's Parent Symposium on Anxiety, there was a psychologist who got up on the screen and said, it is neurologically impossible for the brain to engage in both anxiety and blessing at the same time. In this time of fear, in this time of being sheltered at home, in this time of frustration and anxiety, is there a better exercise than to count our blessings, to give praise, to look for real proof that God is in our life, to develop the lens to be able to see him behind every single little thing, and to give worship? May your week be full of God sightings, and may your worship be bigger. For God is always bigger than we thought. Amen.